Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Chinese literature, from classics to contemporary, this week on Soundings. Join me now for conversations with Victor Mayer of the University of Pennsylvania and with Zhu Hong of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. I'll talk first with Victor Mayer about his translation of the Tao Te Ching, the classic book of Taoist philosophy and religion. Later on the program, Zhu Hong discusses images of women in contemporary Chinese writing. Next to the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, the Tao Te Ching is the most translated text in the world. Known as the classic book of integrity and the way, more than 100 different versions have appeared in English alone. Victor Mayer's new translation of the Tao Te Ching is based on recently discovered manuscripts and available in paperback from Bantam Books. According to Victor Mayer, the Tao Te Ching is a model of brevity and simplicity, but it's also difficult because it's filled with ambiguity and paradox. A word such as integrity, for instance, can be deceptively simple and proves challenging to all translators. Victor Mayer is spending a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center working on a project about Buddhism in medieval China. Reading from his translation of the Tao Te Ching, here's Victor Mayer.
The ancients who practiced the way did not enlighten the people with it. They used it, rather, to stupefy them. The people are hard to rule because they have too much knowledge. Therefore, ruling a state with knowledge is to rob the state. Ruling a state through ignorance brings integrity to the state.
Victor Mayer, your translation here of the Tao Te Ching is simple and yet enormously complicated. Let me ask you to talk about the word that just appears in this reading that you've given us, the word integrity. That's apparently a very difficult thing for a translator to come to.
It's by far the most difficult word to handle in the whole of the Tao Te Ching. The usual translation of de is virtue, but we can't really use that, I believe, anymore since the word virtue in English has a lot of heavy moral connotations, and it's usually a positive term, whereas the word de in Chinese is, at the period in which the Tao Te Ching was written, is a neutral term, and sometimes it even has negative connotations, like malevolent de. So we can't have a positive term, otherwise we end up with oxymorons. negative inferior virtue doesn't sound quite right in English.
Well, there's so many threads to tease out here. Let's see if we can come to a couple of specifics. First of all, tell me about the author of the Tao Te Ching. We have a man whose name is Lao Tzu. Pronounce this for me.
Lao Tzu.
Uh-huh. Now, is this one man? Is this many writers? We have a relationship between an oral tradition and a written tradition. What about that?
There are a whole lot of issues to deal with here, and you raised them simultaneously, but I'll try to unpack them bit by bit. First of all, is it one man or is it a group of men? I believe it's a composite personality, and that, well, let's just look at the meaning of the name. Actually, we can translate it as old master. Lao Tzu literally means old master. Some people think it means old boy, but that's a misinterpretation.
Now, that's not the way we would use a phrase like that in the South.
Right, old boy.
A good old boy.
Good old boy. No, this is the old master, an old philosopher. But there were many old philosophers in China, and this text is actually a compilation of sayings attributed to a variety of old philosophers.
What is the time frame of the Tao Te Ching? It begins and ends, as you as a Chinese literature scholar look back on it and say, we go from zip to zip. What period of time?
Traditionally, Lao Tzu is thought to have lived during the 6th century BCE. Mm-hmm. BCE, by the way, I mean the same as BC. I say BC as before the Common Era.
Right.
So he's generally thought to have lived in the 6th century. And the text, as I see it, formed over a period of about 4 centuries, so that it first came to be written down actually near the end of the 3rd century. And it was probably a process of composition and distillation over those three or four centuries.
Now, I notice at one point in your afterword here, Victor Mayer, of the Tao Te Ching, you say that there is a group of scholars, a group of people who want to believe that there's a single guiding intelligence. This almost elevates the Tao Te Ching into the area of the transcendental, the religious. It's as though God is speaking to the people. And yet that isn't necessarily the case. Are we on the right track here?
Yes. We have to make a distinction between philosophical Taoism, of which this text originally was a part, in religious Taoism, which actually took shape in about the third or fourth century of the Common Era, AD. Certainly for the people who believed in religious Taoism, this text is a sacred text, and they would think of Laozi as a divine figure almost. In fact, they did deify Laozi as a deity, and he would be a single guiding intelligence who gave the scripture to.
And yet, at the outset of our conversation, you mentioned, you emphasized the political nature of the Tao Te Ching, and that brings it down onto the earth. That makes it more of a secular kind of document.
This book originally was, I believe, a handbook for the ruler. It was a way to rule efficiently without undue interference and to keep your head on as you sat on the throne. As it evolved into a religious scripture, different reinterpretations of the text were given, such that it becomes increasingly mystical, increasingly spiritual. But originally, it was a handbook for the ruler.
Is it a handbook for living? Is it the kind of thing that a person in China today could pick up and read and say, this is a document around which I can pattern my life?
Yes, it is, because it is full of great wisdom. A ruler needs wisdom to rule correctly, to rule efficiently, and we can apply these same kinds of concepts to our daily life.
Well, now, you keep using the word ruler, and I'm talking about what, in contrast to that, the ordinary citizen. I mean, when you talk about the ruler, you make me think of Machiavelli and the prince and the manipulation of power. By contrast, what I'm getting at is reading the Tao Te Ching and saying, here are, you know, the Ten Commandments, analogous to that kind of thing. Does it still exist and have that kind of force in Chinese culture?
Well, I keep reiterating the ruler, because this book, actually, when we read through it, we see that most of the maxims are directed to the sage.
It is not king for the ordinary person.
Not really, but we now accept it as being applicable to the ordinary person, because we all look upon ourselves as potential rulers or potential sages. So we can apply these adages, maxims that were intended for a real ruler during the Warring States period of China to our own individual lives.
Victor, give me another for instance here from the Tao Te Ching, this book that you have translated.
Okay, this is chapter 30 in my numbering. In the old numbering, it would be chapter 80. Let there be a small state with few people, where military devices find no use. Let the people look solemnly upon death and banish the thought of moving elsewhere. They may have carts and boats, but there is no reason to ride them. They may have armor and weapons, but they have no reason to display them. Let the people go back to tying knots to keep records. Let their food be savory, their clothes beautiful, their customs pleasurable, their dwellings secure. Though they may gaze across at a neighboring state and hear the sounds of its dogs and chickens, the people will never travel back and forth till they die of old age.
How many translations did you go through, Victor, before you came to your translation? I mean, do you try these lines out on yourself and carry them around in your head and try to figure out which one, as they say in Spanish, soñar, the way it sounds best to you?
I have to go back over these things time and time again, and then, of course, then I send it to my editor, and my editor says, this won't work at all. You've got to take this out and change that. And sometimes I have a real problem holding on to words that I love, but that are apparently inaccessible to the modern reader.
What is the responsibility of a translator of an ancient and an important and a classic text such as the Tao Te Ching? What did you think about your Western readers as you went through this?
Okay, I believe my first duty is to the text. I consider myself a philologist. A philologist is someone who looks at ancient texts and tries to extract meaning about culture from them. So to do that, I feel I have to convey very accurately the meaning of the original text. But if I do that in such a fashion that my reader cannot comprehend it or make any sense of it, then I've failed also. Mm-hmm. So I continually have to balance these two poles, accuracy and readability.
Would you say, Victor, that reading the Tao Te Ching would be instructive for Western audiences in assisting us to understand what's going on politically and culturally in contemporary China today?
Absolutely. I think that we should read this as much for understanding China as we should read it for trying to understand ourselves. Because this is an ethic that has permeated Chinese thought and consciousness for over 2,000 years. And the Chinese think like this. They approach life in this fashion. They approach political problems in the way this book is constructed.
And give me that in 30 seconds. What is the way that this book is constructed, and how does it provide insight into the political ethos of China?
Well, that there are not simple solutions to any human problems. That human problems have two sides or more sides, and that when we can look at Chinese decisions in the political arena, in the international arena, as full of that kind of ambivalence and full of that kind of hedging about things.
Complexities,
yeah. Uh-huh. So that we shouldn't expect that Chinese political leaders are going to take very
direct,
transparent, direct make very direct choices.
Read to me yet again from the Tao Te Ching, Victor Mayer.
Well, this is one of my favorite passages in terms of the literary quality of the book. It's chapter 50 by my numbering and 6 according to the traditional numbering. The valley spirit never dies. It is called the mysterious female. The gate of the mysterious female is called the root of heaven and earth. Gossamer it is, seemingly insubstantial, yet never consumed through use.
Let me get personal for a moment. Why does a passage like that have meaning for you? Why do you find this compelling, aesthetically pleasing?
I like the valley imagery. There are many instances of valley imagery in the Tao Te Ching where it stands for the way. So we associate ways running down through the middle of the valley. I like that kind of combination of nature imagery plus philosophical meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I also like the idea that something which is very insubstantial and ephemeral and soft can really be long-lasting. And it can overcome hardness even. And this is
part of the paradox
of the book, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Victor Mayer, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are the translator of the Tao Te Ching, the classic book of integrity and the way. This is a Bantam New Age book. You teach at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for coming by Soundings. I wish you well in your work.
Thank you very much, Wayne, for having me.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Chinese literature from classics to contemporary, this week on Soundings. Join me now for a conversation with Zhu Hong of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Zhu Hong is working on a twofold study of images of women in Chinese fiction and the sexual politics of contemporary Chinese writing. According to Zhu Hong, women's liberation in China has its own special characteristics. She says that although Chinese women were supposedly liberated at the time of the Communist Revolution in the late 40s, they continue to suffer from discrimination under both the state and the patriarchal family. Only since the mid-1970s have Chinese women begun to speak out for their rights in their own voices. Zhu Hong is the author of many books and articles about Chinese, English, and American literature. Among her recent publications is The Serenity of Whiteness, a collection of contemporary short stories from China by and about women, available in paperback from Ballantine Books. I asked Zhu Hong to reflect on the history of women's writing in China.
It is new in the sense that women were considered, best seen and not heard, and even better not seen at all. Mm. And so of course there were talented, you know, women writers in Chinese history, but never to this extent. There was a flowering of Chinese women's writing in the May 4th movement, that's, you know, in the early 20s. But they are, you know, women writers write about, you know, of course they sometimes write about bigger issues, but when they write about women, they really write about how women are discriminated against in spite of the, you know, wanted liberation of women, discriminated on the job, mm-hmm. and, you know, put down in the family, they still is expected to play traditional roles. And also, you know, recently women writers write about more sensitive topics like sexual harassment on the job. You know, it exists in China.
What forms of literary expression do these themes take? Poetry, novels, short stories? How widely do they circulate?
It's mostly short or long fiction, and they are circulated very widely. Mm-hmm. You know, many women writers are very popular, you know, read by everybody who reads and then made into films.
Is this an overt kind of thing, Zhu Hong? That is to say, would you look at it and say that would a Western reader read your translations and say, to be direct about it, this is heavy-handed, ideologically speaking? How subtle do you have to be on the other side of the story?
Well, perhaps, you know, to Western readers who are more, you know, used to, you know, like writings from Latin America, you know, that kind of translation, uh-huh. Chinese stories may be a little bit more ideological, you know. But, you know, now Chinese writers have been, you know, they have been exposed to writings from the West, and their own writings are getting more sophisticated.
Let me ask you about this, Zhu Hong. The one stereotype about the Chinese people is that it is essentially a peasant society. Mm-hmm. What about the problem of literacy? I mean, you have the impulse of feminism, you have the impulse of women's writing. Are you, in fact, in practice, going to reach wide audiences because of a literacy problem?
Well, you must really, we're really talking about the urban population, and that mm-hmm. is big enough, you know. But, you know, women, people in China read much more than they do in this country. We don't have so many other forms of entertainment, and people read a lot for entertainment.
Is the kind of work that you were doing, Zhu Hong, circulating formally, therefore, in the educational circles of China? And the second question is, do you have a problem with the party because of that?
Well, I try to act as a kind of a cultural or literary bridge between the two cultures and between women of the two cultures. Hmm. So I have translated and edited a short fiction of American women writers in China, the first of its kind. And I've put out a dictionary of world women writers, you know, to introduce world women writers to China. And then I'm now trying to introduce Chinese women writers to the United States.
You have a big task here in front mm-hmm. of you. Name some of the women writers from the West that you are taking to these Chinese audiences.
Oh, In that collection, that collection started with Kate Chopin and mm-hmm. included all the main American woman writers, Charlotte Perkins Gilman. They are in the earlier ones, and it includes like Mary McCarthy, Joyce Carol Oates, you know, Tilly Olson, uh-huh. Grace Paley. I also wrote articles about Grace Paley. They are widely translated later, uh-huh. but I was the first and I put them together in a collection.
I congratulate you on this.
Thank
what
you.
About Chinese women writers that you are introducing to American or Western readers?
Well, my book of translations, many thanks to the National Humanities Center and other foundations and centers which helped me, it is just out as of now. And I included some well-known Chinese woman writers like Feng Zhongpu and Dai Qing, you know, who has already, you know, been known here. But I included a lot of provincial writers, you know, from border, you know, provinces of China, which who have never been translated before.
Do you have a sense of how American or Western readers are taking to these contemporary Chinese women writers, receiving them?
I don't know. I hope it will, you know, I hope that they will like them. Anyway, my book is in paperback, and I've already seen one favorable review in the papers, you know. And because they talk about Chinese women, and I try to introduce stories which are more appealing to an American audience, like abortion, the problem of choice or no choice, also the disillusion with romantic love, you know, and the mother-daughter relationships, you know, and like the struggle for space, physical and mental and emotional space.
What about the question of human rights? This is a very sticky issue, a very thorny issue. Pick your metaphor. The work that you're doing, how does it...
Let me start this way. There's a theory in China that women in China, they have... paper rights, but not real rights. And the issue now is to acquire their real rights through enhancing their ability. And how do you enhance their ability? By education. And so if they're more educated, they'll be more able to take advantage of their paper rights and transform it into real rights. But I have a problem with this theory because in China, women are deprived of education. You know, they're discriminated against in education. So I said to one of the proponents of this theory lately when we met at a conference, I said, you know, you're going around in a circle because girls are being taken out of school, you know, all over the country.
What do you want for your grandchildren, Zhu Hong, whether they're little girls or little boys?
Well, I would prefer little girls, perhaps. And I want them to be able, you know, to decide, you know, their own life, you know, and, you know, not be discriminated against. And I hope that in their generation, it will come to pass.
Are you optimistic about an alignment between goals and expectations with regard to issues such as human rights in the West and in China? I've been told that that progress, that movement toward those goals in China is real, but it's very slow, and it's a very formal, ceremonial kind of process that we have to go through.
I think that the women's issues will contribute. I was disappointed that the students in the movement in 89 did not raise women's issues because it is the abuses are very flagrant and it is growing. Women are suffering from, you know, the state, the traditional values, and now since the 80s. Suffering from market forces. They are now thrown on the market without protection in many cases. So, and that is why there are so many women writers. But this was never raised, and I was disappointed. And I think since you can't really challenge the party on legal grounds, so that's why women's writing are so important in exposing all the problems.
Zhu Hong, do you feel comfortable as... How do you think of yourself as an expatriate? I mean, when you are in mainland China, how are you and your work received? Do you walk in a with a sort of circle around you? What?
Not really, because I still keep to academic and literary writing, but I always want to link my own work with the real situation.
Because you're an academic, are you looked at as harmless? I mean, is there a force, to, a weight to what academics do in the culture in mainland China?
Of course, there's always censorship, you know. But I've been in the profession for over 30, nearly 40 years, and there's ups and downs because, you know, sometimes you are in a campaign and sometimes there's a respite between campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And... I always keep an eye on the cultural scene and want to link my own writings about Anglo-American literature, link it to real, you know, link it to thorny ideological or literary issues in China, I think that will make it, you know, give it a bigger impact instead of just introducing mm-hmm. an author.
You're a brave person.
Well, thank you. I just try.
Zhu Hong, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are a professor at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, the Institute for Foreign Literature. Your most recent book is called The Serenity of Whiteness. This is a collection of translations of work by Chinese women writers into English. Just been published in paperback by Ballantine. You're also working on a project here at the Center, Images of Women in Contemporary Chinese Fiction. You have an alternative title for that. What is it?
I'm thinking of calling it The Room or a Broom. It's because it's women looking for a room of their own and perhaps getting the broom.
Well, that's a wonderful working title. Zhu Hong, thank you very much for your participation on Soundings. Good luck in your work.
Thank you. I enjoyed this.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations about Chinese literature from the classics to the contemporary. The speakers were Victor Mayer of the University of Pennsylvania and Zhu Hong of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 610. That's program number 610, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, Literature and Gender. My guests will be Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick of Duke University and Peter Brooks of Yale University. Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick will discuss Queer and Now, her study of homosexuality and literary culture. Peter Brooks will talk about his book, Storied Bodies, a study of the body in modern narrative. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Chinese Women and Chinese Wisdom, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Victor Mayer of the University of Pennsylvania and Zhu Hong of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Victor Mayer is the translator of the Tao Te Ching, the classic book of Chinese religion and philosophy. Zhu Hong is the editor of a new collection of contemporary Chinese literature by and about women. Chinese Women, Chinese Wisdom, this week on Soundings.